The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Hi, this is Kevin McCullough. Thanks for listening to the Christian Outlook podcast, where we cover today's issues from a perspective that honors your Christian faith. Our podcast is brought to you through a partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. Here's another piece I trust you'll enjoy.
It was an eye-opening, startling experience for me to come to the realization that human trafficking is very much alive all over the world today, even taking place here in the United States. And it takes place in many fashions for a lot of different reasons. In China, walking along a street in a major city of the South one day and seeing a number of young girls, some of whom had obvious limbs missing, had been maimed, perhaps, I thought, in an accident of some sort. And in talking with a missionary friend and interpreter, I began to inquire about the alarming number of young ladies that I saw on this particular street that seemed to have a missing arm or a missing hand, something of this nature. And I inquired as to why this was, feeling it was kind of unusual. He went on to explain to me that, well, these are cast-offs. These are young girls who had been kidnapped from their home villages, brought into major cities, and sold as sex slaves, largely the tourist trade. And on occasions, these young girls would fail to cooperate, would perhaps try to turn their captors into the authorities, and so as retribution, they would typically cut off an arm or a hand to maim them in one fashion or another, as a means of disfiguring them, making them less desirable, handicapping their ability to earn a living, and ultimately punishing them for not being cooperative with the sex traffickers. That opened my eyes to what has become a global problem. And as we talk about this topic today, I'm joined by Sean Litton. Sean is Vice President of Field Operations on behalf of International Justice Missions. They direct casework operations around the world in places from Latin America to Africa, South Asia, and Southeast Asia, developing intervention strategies and advocating with local and national authorities to address the problem of human trafficking around the globe. And Sean, great to have you on the program today.
Craig, it's wonderful to be with you. Thank you.
That experience that I had in China a number of years ago, I sadly have come to discover, was not a unique and rare one, but in fact is taking place in more and more places around the globe today, even in so-called developed nations. Tell us why.
Well, the main problem, as we see it, is in countries where the laws against these crimes are not enforced at all. In other words, the traffickers, the criminals, the pimps who are selling these children have no fear of any sanction, no fear of any repercussion, no fear of any negative consequences, and so they engage in this practice with impunity, despite the fact that in almost every country today, it's against the law. It's against the law to sell children for sex.
And yet, in spite of that, of course, we see the sex trafficking trade growing pretty significantly. Of course, we've perhaps caught a special or two of what goes on in places such as parts of Southeast Asia and countries that we're all too familiar with, Thailand, for example. And as this sex trafficking trade is growing and developing, talk to us a bit about, number one, how girls get even pulled into all of this. And why it seemingly is being allowed to flourish in some countries.
Right. So the children that get involved typically are migrating. So they're from very poor and impoverished areas, and someone comes to their village, somebody from their same ethnic group. They generally refer to them as an auntie. They come to the village, maybe they're from the village or a nearby village, and they tell their parents, you know, I can help your daughter find a good job in the city. The daughter feels a debt of gratitude to her parents in many of these cultures, and she's obligated to care for them. And so she wants to help her parents, so she'll go with this auntie. And then the auntie, it turns out, is a trafficker. And rather than give her a good job or take care of her, this young woman will be sold into a brothel. And once there, she's locked away. She's kept from going for help. But even if she could go for help, usually she doesn't speak the local language. She sees the police coming by the brothel and collecting money every week, so there's really nowhere for her to turn. She has no access to her family. They're from a village up in the hills or far, far away, or even in another country in many cases. And she's literally trapped. And then if she refuses to participate, if she refuses to cooperate, they'll deny her food. In many cases, she'll be beaten. She'll be forced to watch pornography. And just over time, they will wear her will down until she submits. She submits herself to this abuse that goes on day after day after day after day.
And these girls, Sean, literally get trapped into this scenario. They're far away from home. They're embarrassed about the circumstances that have taken place. And quite often, those that are engaged in the sex trafficking threaten these girls and their families, don't they?
Absolutely, yes. And so, you know, the trafficker will tell the girl, "I paid good money for you. And if you don't cooperate, then, you know, I will find your family." Or there'll be stories of girls who have attempted to run away only to be brought back and killed in front of the other girls to frighten them into submission and cooperation.
It's pretty horrifically manipulative, isn't it? I mean, aside from the horror of what they're drawing these young girls into, quite often, as you suggest, they are trying to better their station in life, maybe move from a village into the city with the hope and promise of earning more money to take care of their family. Maybe there's somebody in the family that's ill. They need money because of additional medical expenses, things of this sort. We've even seen cases of human sex trafficking taking place where women and men sometimes are being lured with promises of immigration into the United States. And if you come over, we'll help pay your way and get you into the country, things of this sort, only to find out that once they arrive here, not having any contacts, having no command of the language, suddenly they're being forced into sex slavery.
Exactly, yeah. And they have, you know, their passport, if they had one, has been taken away, so they're in the country illegally, and they feel there's nowhere to turn. If they go to the authorities, they'll be arrested for, you know, illegal immigration.
We've seen the stories, as I mentioned earlier, coming out of places like Thailand, the Philippines, other so-called even sex tourism destinations. And certainly I think there's a growing sense of awareness of the problem globally. But I'm curious, Sean, based on your years of involvement with international justice missions, I understand you, in fact, came out of private practice in your own law firm to be involved in this ministry organization. Are we hearing more of these stories simply because the reporting is getting better, or are we hearing more of these stories because the horrificness of this crime is on the increase?
It's hard to say exactly. There certainly is a great deal more reporting and a great deal of more attention being focused on this issue. But at the same time, what you have is massive economic migration happening as people in more and poorer countries move towards those who are more wealthy, where there's more jobs. And this is part of globalization. It's part of a global phenomena. At the same time, more and more roads are getting into these villages, you know, that have been formerly isolated and safe and by their isolation. And so then the traffickers have access to more and more people to move into the sex trade. So it's a combination of both greater attention on the issue, and again, I do think that's expanding as the process of globalization and the process of economic migration increases.
Talk to us a bit about the role that International Justice Missions is taking in not only addressing increased awareness of this, creating a more hostile environment for those engaged in the trafficking and the slavery end of all of this, but then, too, the hope that your organization is providing in helping to get these women and sometimes men out of this terrible lifestyle.
Right. So when in our offices, so for example, I worked in an office in Thailand, also an office in the Philippines. So we'll do investigations, and we have undercover investigators that will go out and locate these establishments that are selling children for sex. We'll document the identity of those children, the identity of the individuals that are selling them. We'll We'll bring that back. We have a team of lawyers that will review it. We'll write a report, and then we'll go to the local authorities and advocate with the authorities. And the evidence that we bring of the, it's a violation of law, but now they have such strong evidence of it that they can't deny it's happening. And so we'll push them and push them until they take action. And then the object there is to ensure that the girls are rescued and that the individuals that were exploiting them are brought to justice. So there's an arrest, criminal prosecution of the traffickers and the pimps and the brothel owners, hopefully leading to conviction, a sentence in prison. And then for the girls, we have teams of social workers that work with them and different homes. We call them aftercare homes, working on dealing with the consequences of the abuse, both in terms of their emotional health, their spiritual health, and trying to find out whether they can return home, whether that's a viable option. If not, what would be a viable life option for them, and giving them education and skills so that they can have new life.
We're talking about the plight of human trafficking around the globe. And, you know, it's interesting because so often when we think of slavery, we put it contextually in America, historically, into what happened here in the United States and many parts of the globe back in the 1800s. And it seems to be somewhat satisfying to think that we've dealt with the issue here at home, and therefore it's no longer a problem. It's no longer our problem. But is it? Well, it is, in fact, at many levels. Not only does it continue to be a global problem, but in fact, in many respects, it's our problem. Both in terms of the fact that many of these women that are being kidnapped or given promises of a new life in America, brought here to be engaged, and they find out later, in the sex trade, and then literally end up getting trapped in that lifestyle with no avenue to turn, and here illegally, fearful of seeking out any assistance from police or the authorities. And then moreover, growing numbers of people who travel abroad to engage in so-called sex tourism. It's a sad, sad state of affairs, and yet one that as reporting perhaps gets a better, awareness increases, is something that all of us need to be more educated upon and do something to bring justice to these people. Sean Litton is with us. And Sean, let's talk a bit about the problem, whether it goes from sexual assault, bonded labor. I mean, there's a variety of reasons why this kind of human trafficking is taking place. And as we suggest, it's not just a problem in the West, it's a problem globally. Even the continent of Africa, we're seeing this take place.
Yeah, it is a global phenomenon, and it's important to understand that when we talk about human trafficking, we're not just talking about sexual slavery or sex trafficking. It's any type of labor without consent. We're basically talking about slavery. It takes many different forms. So it could be working on a cocoa plantation and West Africa, or working on a fishing boat, forced little boys forced to work in a fishing boat in Ghana, or, you know, it could be young girls in brothels in Southeast Asia, or people working in a brick kiln or a rice mill or a rock quarry in India. So it takes many different forms, but it's all slavery.
Even we've seen recent increased awareness of the so-called blood diamond trade, too.
Mm, yeah, that's another area where anytime, you know, there's a lack of law enforcement and a permissive atmosphere where people need labor, it's always going to, you know, slave labor is always cheaper, right? But if there's no law enforcement, then there's no reason for the people who own the facility to pay. So they can just trick people into it. There's a plentiful supply of people who are desperate for work.
This is a problem taking place at many tiers in the West, in the developed nations, in developing nations, and one that I think needs to be dealt with at a variety of levels. Talk to us a bit about the role and uniquely that IJM is playing in all of this.
Well, the first thing that we're doing is in the places where we're working in Southeast Asia and India and Africa and Latin America, we're basically shining a flashlight right on the issue. But a lot of people will say there's terrible trafficking, but to actually go in, to work undercover, to actually document the situation, to show exactly how it's happening, and then to collaborate with the local justice authorities to take action against the perpetrators and to ensure the rescue and restoration of the victims. But that's not enough. It's just not enough to rescue the girls. You've got to do something that prevents other girls, other young women, other people from experiencing this abuse. And in order for that to happen, there needs to be a reliable deterrent. There has to be an end to impunity. And so we work with in building the capacity and the will of the local justice system to actually enforce the law and extend the protection of the law to all the vulnerable young women in the area, so that, you know, the brothel owners move away from working with women against their will from trafficking in young children.
Is this casual, or are there degrees where it's highly organized and coordinated? I ask that question because there seems to be so many layers of this web that's taking place to, you know, kidnap women in one part of the world, manage to abscond them and get them into countries like the United States, and then get them into a system over here. It would seem to me that at certain levels, Sean, this isn't very casual, but in fact, highly organized.
Yeah. So it's true that there's a full range. So, for example, in the United States, it is highly organized. You're dealing with organized crime. Same thing in Eastern Europe. In Asia, there are places where the criminals are highly organized. In other places, it's just a simple brothel that's being run by, you know, a local businessman, et cetera, a local pimp. In terms of the labor trafficking, it could just actually be the regular business practice of that area, is that you trick people into working in your brick kiln or your rice mill, and then you hold them there. And you never let them leave, and you pay them just enough to buy enough food to live, and it's a regular business practice. So it's not even seen as a crime, even though it's against the law.
I know that your organization has been successful at creating some pretty successful pilot programs in certain parts of the world. I know specifically in Metro Cebu in the Philippines over the last several years. You, in working with local authorities and spreading out throughout the region, have been successful, I understand, Sean, in seeing a reduction in child sex trafficking of nearly 80%?
Yeah, that's true. So in that case, it was a pilot project, and there was a measurement taken by a group of international criminologists to get a level of what was the level of abuse happening in the city. And then we instituted our program, basically increasing the capacity of law enforcement, the capacity of local prosecution, the judiciary, working with aftercare facilities to increase the level of services going to victims. And then 3 years later, when they came back and did another measurement to see the effect of the arrests and the rescues and all the rehabilitation, they found 80% fewer girls being exploited in the city and in the metropolitan area, and 75% fewer establishments that had any children at all. It was a pretty amazing result.
In addition to not only reducing the atmosphere that allows this typically to flourish, providing victim relief, aftercare, accountability then too for the perpetrators of all of this, long-term transformation, do you get the sense that we're starting to make some headway and moving in the right direction?
Absolutely. In the Philippines, for example, so after we instituted that project and the government saw the results, they came to us and said, can you help us on a national level? And the key issue with all these projects is, are they sustainable? In other words, unless it's the government itself doing it, no organization like IJM or any other organization could sustain it on their own. But in this case, the Philippines took the model in Cebu and is now replicating it throughout the country with their own money, their own resources. They're setting up new police units. They're expediting the prosecution of trafficking cases. They're increasing the capacity of the aftercare systems. The government's doing this on their own, and so we're seeing the ripple effect of just one model of showing how it can work to increase the enforcement of the law, can reduce the problem, and now it's being replicated throughout the entire country. And then the other countries where we're working, we're seeing the same effect, that gradually, it's happening at a slower rate, but gradually, as people see the results, they want to put more energy into it.
And of course, your organization is helping to spearhead a lot of this, educate folks. And toward that end, we mentioned the fact that you are in town speaking at a conference dealing with this very issue. If ultimately, Sean, folks want to find out more about how they can get involved in partnering with IJM to make a difference and the role that the church needs to be playing, quite frankly, from the standpoint of our justice obligation, what kind of resources are available through the IJM website toward that end?
Well, the website is by far the best place to start. There's also an app you can download if you have a smartphone. You can follow us on Twitter or Facebook. There's a book called Good News About a Justice that you can find, you know, through the website or through a bookseller, that kind of lays the foundation for what we're doing, what the biblical foundation is for seeking justice for the poor and the oppressed. You can become a Freedom Partner. You can support the organization financially. You can pay for the rescue that the poor cannot afford to buy for themselves. You can sign up to receive our upcoming holiday gift catalog. You can give the gift of rescue to people. And most importantly, and what I'd love for people to do, is join us as prayer partners. You can do that through the website, and then you'll get updates on kind of where we're working, the obstacles we're running up against, and you can help us through prayer. You can actually pray for these operations that we're trying to get done to rescue these people.
Absolutely. But ultimately, we want to encourage folks to not only get educated, get involved prayerfully, but get behind supporting the organization and working in countries globally on a variety of continents. We mentioned Latin America, Africa, South Asia, Southeast Asia. You can get more information again online at IJM. That's for International Justice Missions, IJM.org. And Sean Litton, Vice President, Field Operations for International Justice Missions, we appreciate the time.
Thank you so much, Craig. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Christian Outlook. Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. If you enjoy our podcast, take a moment and tell a friend to subscribe today.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.